Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello everyone, welcome again to our penultimate film in the season of the wastelands of the post-apocalypse. I've forgotten what actual number episode this is, but anyway, it's the ninth film, I can tell you that much.
Yes, and, it is the ninth film.
Yeah, so I am Adrian Smith and I am joined as ever by Rod Barnett. Hello Rod.
Hello Adrian.
How are things for you over there in America land?
They're fine. They're complicated. I'm attempting to buy a house, and it's as complicated and time-consuming and brain-bending and eye-poking as all of these types of situations always are, from what I understand.
Now people can start to imagine, what would Rod's dream house look like?
Yeah, well, don't worry. I'm not getting my dream house, no matter what I do. I can't afford my dream house, so yeah.
I'm thinking cinema in the basement, something like that. Tiki lounge out on the porch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a patio tiki lounge, that'd be perfect. Yeah. That'd be great.
Oh, yeah, well, yes, you have my sympathies. That is not easy.
No, it's a difficult, headache-inducing nightmare.
Mm. Oh, good. Well, hey, welcome to the podcast. And one could almost say, Rod, that this might fill you with rage.
Yes, it might, except that I actually enjoyed this film, so I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah. No, I meant buying a house.
Buying a house, definitely. But yeah. a film. Well, I would love to know if it was better known as just Rage or A Man Called Rage. But because I think A Man Called Rage is actually the better title, because just Rage, that could be anything. That could be almost any story of any type. Yeah.
The title of this film is something we can definitely dig into. Was there, have you got anything before we get to that point, anything you've got coming up?
Just continuing various podcasts and, got one coming out, fairly soon on, another Italian post-apocalyptic film that, we did over on the Bloody Pit with a couple of friends of mine.
You've been post-apocalypsing with other people.
Yes, but I'll be honest. I didn't realize what I was doing until it was too late, and then I was like, "I'll just have to confess to my cheating ways with Adrian." Yeah. I apologize.
Oh, right. What is that one?
Rats, Night of Terror.
Oh, you know, yes. Well, I'm glad you've done that, because I've been feeling that maybe we should have done it, and it was remiss of me to leave it off the list. So if you've done it, that's great. We can just. We could just point people in that direction.
It's highly entertaining. I've always enjoyed it ever since I first saw it about 20 years ago, and so I knew I eventually wanted to see it.
Which is not something you can say about all Bruno Mattei films.
No, and maybe I should be putting quotes around enjoy with any Bruno Mattei films.
Yeah, yes. And entertaining.
Well, no, that's just it. I do find it very entertaining, but, you know, often not. When I find his work entertaining, it's often for reasons that are not intentional. So,
right. Yes, fair enough. Yes, no, I'm glad you've done that, because there have been times with some of the films that we've done. And there was one in particular that was full of rats. I've forgotten which one that was. They all blend into one. And that did make me think, oh, maybe we should have done that one. Oh, that's good. Well, so is that episode coming soon, or will it be out by the time people hear this?
No, it'll be out probably in about a week after they hear this episode.
Right. Good. Something to look forward to. The only thing I wanted to really plug at the moment, our commentary track that we keep banging on about still hasn't been announced, so we can't plug that. But I did just have a large, like, I don't know, 8 or 10 page article published in the magazine The Sensational 60s, which is a magazine published over here in the UK by Hemlock Books, who do, I'm sure many of you have seen Hemlock Books. They do lots of great books. They did the recent one about AIP called Witches, Bitches and Banshees and all that. Anyway, so in their latest issue of The Sensational 60s, it's a spy-themed issue with things on Our Man Flint and Harry Palmer and Matt Helm and stuff like that.
I love those movies, yeah.
But then randomly in the middle is a big article by me on the Margariti space films, primarily focusing on the Gamma One films, but I did go out of my way to talk about the other ones as well, because he actually made 6 in the 60s, so they're all in there. So obviously we've talked about some of those on the podcast before, but yeah, so that's in print now with lots of pictures, and I'm quite pleased with that. Cool, it gave me a chance to review, to revisit and watch pretty much back to back all of the Gamma One films again. And also, I mean, the names already are swimming around in my head. The Claude Rains one that he made.
Battle of the Worlds.
I mean, yeah, that's all. And then, of course, Assignment Outer Space as well. So, yeah, if you want to read what I had to say about those films, spoiler alert, I said they're good. But I go into the history of them all a bit more, and you know, who the producers were behind them, and all of that. So, oh, and also the connections with the Green Slime, which people often think is part of that series. So I sort of go into more detail about why there's a connection, all of that. So anyway, that is out now. If you want to order yourself a copy, you can get it directly from Hemlock Books, and I don't know whether it makes it into shops anywhere or goes to distributors overseas. I've got no idea. But anyway, it's nice, it's glossy, it's colourful. And there's also some stuff in there about Hammer and all kinds of things. So there you go. Nice to be in print talking about Margariti again.
Yes, yes. So thank you. I would just nod my head to you and thank you for doing so.
Yeah, it's good. I'm glad when they ask me to do stuff like that. I don't have time. I mean, I don't have time for any of this stuff, right? But I can't say no. I mean, do you want to write about the Gamma One films? I'm not going to say, oh, I'm really busy. Of course I'm going to say yes. So there it is. Right, but to get back to the matter in hand, we are talking about a post-apocalyptic world where a soldier of fortune will enter the Forbidden Land for a change. And bump into all those other guys who've also entered the Forbidden Lands,
probably just over the next hill, probably.
Yeah, and we've had people going into the Forbidden Lands looking for water, and we've had them looking for, I don't know, a pregnant woman at one point. I'm sure that was one of the films we watched.
Petroleum.
Yes, and this time they're looking to find something that you would think is all over the place in a post-nuke world.
You would think.
Apparently not. But anyway, so we are, of course, talking about the film Rage.
On speed, John Glenn.
Thank you. Yeah, so as you mentioned, Rod, we've got Rage, a.k.a. A Man Called Rage, a.k.a. Rush 2.
Yes, yes.
A.k.a. Fuoco Incrociato, which actually translates as crossfire, which was, I don't think that was used for any of the, like, no one called it crossfire, apart from in Italy. So let's just, first of all, I mean, we could approach this from a number of angles, but I thought we could mention the fact that in some territories, it was known as Rush 2. And this is because the film is starring, I have to say, I'm looking at the names and all that, I didn't know anybody involved in this film at all. It's like a whole new scene of Italian exploitation people I'd never heard of before coming to this movie.
Hmm.
So the director is Tonino Ricci, and our star is a chap called Bruno Minetti, known as Conrad Nichols, which is a good Western-sounding name. And so Bruno Minetti had starred in a film the previous year by the same director called Rush. So I wanted to ask you, Rob, before we dig into their back catalogues a bit more, have you seen Rush? Did you know Rush?
No, I've been aware of it for years, but I've never seen it.
The plot description, from what I can tell from the book that we're using, When the World Ends, it sounds like a post-apocalypse version of Rambo.
Really?
Basically, yeah. Sounds like, and the poster even makes him look quite a lot like Rambo, if you look at imagery for Rush.
Well, yeah, okay.
So when they made, and the character's name was Rush, so you can see why in this film they just called him Rage. But then in some of the dubbed versions of this movie, particularly in Germany, they just dubbed his name as Rush again and made this a direct sequel.
Very smart of them. That's a wise marketing move almost every time. Yeah.
So that's why in some places this is known as Rush 2. But yeah, also, like we said, A Man Called Rage, or just Rage.
Well, just out of curiosity, apparently he's generally better known for a film called Night of the Sharks from 1988, but I've never seen that either.
Who are we talking about, Bruno Minetti or?
Oh no, I'm sorry. It's kind of a I'm talking about the director, because here's the thing you'll notice. Okay. Here's the thing you'll notice is that this particular actor primarily turns up in the 80s in movies by the director of this film.
Yes, yeah, he's repeatedly in a bunch, isn't he? Yeah, okay, so let's take a sideways step and look at Tonino Ricci, a director I had never heard of, and I now want to watch all of his films because they've got such great names. The Great Chihuahua Treasure Hunt, I mean, who doesn't want to watch that?
Oh, everybody wants amazing to see that. How could you stop yourself?
He made another shark film in the 70s called The Shark's Cave. I mean, I'm surprised, Rod, that you've never seen Night of the Sharks. That sounds right up your street.
It really does, and clearly it's just not crossed my path. I will say this, besides now having seen A Man Called Rage, the only other film of his that I can definitely assure you that I have seen is one you would probably expect, Thor the Conqueror from 1983.
Yes, also starring our man here.
Yeah, and that's the thing I immediately noticed is, like, okay, they were joined at the hip there for a period in the 80s. And Thor the Conqueror I've seen. Now, I remember kind of enjoying it. I don't remember if I enjoyed it, you know, because it was actually good, or if I enjoyed it because of its flaws being exactly the kind of flaws that I expect from a film of this type. But those are the only two. Now that I've seen this one, Thor the Conqueror is the only other one I've seen. Okay. And I have to say, I could understand someone enjoying, just from these two, enjoying this director's work enough to really want to dig in and just have fun.
I mean, he made you know, an Indiana Jones type film called Raiders of the Magic Ivory, which I obviously now really want to see. He did another film after Rage, again with our man Bruno, like a war film called Days of Fire or Days of Hell. He was, you know, like so many of the directors we've looked at, he's just working in whatever genre was making money at the time. He's done westerns, he's done kind of gangster type films, He's done erotic films. There's one that the plot summary is just sends shivers down my spine. I've mentioned this before when we talked ages ago about Italian sex comedies, and I mentioned how one of the recurring themes was incest in a lot of these films.
Yes.
So in 1977, Tonino Ricci made a film called Passion. And the plot summary just says here, despite the fact that their relationship is not good at all, Marina agrees to attend one of the orgies that her brother Alberto is very fond of. And like, the one person you wouldn't want to go to an orgy with is your sister, right?
Awkward. You maybe drive there together, but yeah. I don't know that. Yeah. It sounds like it would be. Yeah, I think the word awkward that you chose there is probably accurate. Yeah.
But yeah, he was just making, you know, whatever. And he did work on. He was also second unit and did things like White Fang for Lucio Fulci. Super Argo, which is a film, one of the Super Argo films. We're going to talk about Super Argo in our next big season. He worked on Peplum films as well, and
yeah, he did some assistant. He did some assistant director stuff in the 60s.
Yeah,
that's how he cut his teeth and got himself into the director's chair eventually. I mean, apparently he was even an assistant director on Bava's Eric the Conqueror. So
an experienced guy who just worked with whatever he was given, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to try and check out more of his films now that I'm aware.
Well,
of
him. Like I say, I've seen a lot of mention of Night of the Sharks as being something that he's kind of known for. Apparently, that's one of his better movies, and so I'm curious about it. Even though,
I mean, it's got Treat Williams and Antonio Fargas in it, so
exactly, and that's enough right there to probably bump it up.
And John Steiner.
And Christopher Connolly, Christopher Connolly as well, who we've seen multiple times in this show.
Yes, of course. Well, if you're listening and you've seen Night of the Sharks, do send us a little review. Tell us what you think of it. So Tonino Ricci, a director who I've now got some homework to do. Let's just talk about our star. Again, none of this cast I was familiar with. So this is an Italian-Spanish co-production,
mm-hmm.
Meaning primarily Italian film crew shooting in Almeria, we've been there before with some of these other films. So the cast as well are a mixture, primarily Italian and Spanish, and one of the co-stars is Austrian. But Bruno Minetti, he's got the look, hasn't he? Like for yes. An action hero in an early 80s film, he's got it down. Like if you asked AI to generate a picture of an 80s action hero, this is who you'd get.
Pretty much. I mean, it's a cross between Clint Eastwood, Kurt Russell, and any random. I mean, you know, maybe a little Sylvester Stallone thrown in there, maybe. But yeah, pretty much, yeah.
He's got these, you know, sort of high neck. I don't even know what you call that, sleeveless shirt.
Oh yeah.
It's quite an interesting look, and he's so his face is so chiseled, and his hair is so perfect. That's what I really love about this film. Like in the future, there may not be law and order, but there will be hairspray and lip gloss.
There will be permanence, that's for sure.
I mean, the women have got perfect makeup. This guy is styled within an inch of his life. Oh, it's just so good.
Okay, quick sidebar. There comes a point where the attractive female co-star, who we've seen in the movie for a little while at this point, then gets herself kitted up to go out on this on this. Very dangerous mission they're going to go on, and somewhere she managed to find a halter top and hot and the shortest short shorts in the history of time.
That's the standard military issue. Like they're all wearing. We're getting way yes.
Sorry.
The cost. Yeah. Well, so this film, I still want to talk about this guy, but yeah, the film, it feels like one of those where they said, okay. We've got access to this set of an abandoned street.
Yes.
We've got this many vehicles, two motorbikes. We've got a bunch of army surplus clothes in a shed. What can you make? That's kind of what they've done, I think.
Yes.
They've written the, it feels like a script written around what they had available. But yeah, so the guys are all wearing sort of mismatched army surplus gear, primarily looking like they've borrowed it from a World War II movie that was just filming down the road.
Probably, and, yes.
But then, yeah, but then the female, like they're, when they have to put on their special nuclear radiation protection suits, they're basically just like little plastic ponchos.
Just to keep the dust off of them, I assume.
But then, yeah, when she's going out on this dangerous mission into the Forbidden Lands, she's wearing hot pants. It's brilliant.
I know.
So,
It's so crazy. Well, as far as the cast is concerned, because there's a lot to say about this cast. Mm. I'm not sure which actor you'd like to talk about next, but I think we would be remiss if we did not speak about Stelio Candelli.
Uh-huh.
The actor who plays Slash.
Yes. Well, okay. Let's go in that order. So we'll start with Bruno, then we'll go to his friend / enemy or frenemy.
Frenemy.
I suppose.
Frenemy is exactly what I wrote down.
Yeah. All right. And then then we'll talk about the two supporting cast, including the hot pants. So Bruno again. So all these people, never heard of any of them. Bruno Minniti. Like you said, mostly seems to have been in the films as his alter ego, Conrad Nichols, for the same director for a good few years. But he was also, again, he did a few sex comedies in the 70s, which, I don't know, given the look that he has, I'm sort of intrigued by. One film, of course, that immediately caught my eye is called The Porno Killers.
Caught my eye as well, from 1980.
That's quite an intriguing one. I don't know if there's ever a version of that out there anywhere, but there are reviews of it, so people must have seen it. And it sounds like a sort of sleazy giallo, late giallo type thing about hit women who have to go and get some money from an international drugs deal. I don't know. It sounds pretty funny, but he's in it.
Sounds like fun to me.
Yeah, it's quite an amusing premise. So yeah, I mean, have you seen anything else that this guy's been in apart from Thor?
Only Thor, that, like I say, that stands out simply because of the name of the film and the character, and my obsessive, stupid love of barbarian movies from the 1980s. So
yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It's like we've suddenly discovered a whole new. It's like we've been in a gold mine all this time that was running dry, and then right towards the end. We've suddenly hit a new scene of all these new people and things. So Stelio Candelli playing Slash, but not that Slash, a different Slash.
Yes.
He is quite an accomplished actor who has been in a lot of quite recognizable things. I knew him from Demons, which he did a couple of years after this, but also Hercules, which obviously we've talked about before.
He was actually in his younger years in Planet of the Vampires for Mario Bava and Last of the Vikings, which Bava had something to do with as well. So yeah.
Oh right, okay.
Yeah.
He's one of the astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Oh, there we go. I'd forgotten that. Yes, and westerns. He did a few of those.
Quite a few.
Sartana and Trinity and a whole bunch. Were there any other films of his or was anything you wanted to mention specifically?
Well,
about
him? I'm a fan of an admittedly bad but very fun movie called Yeti, Giant of the 20th Century, and he has a part in that as well. He plays Dr. William in Nude for Satan from 1974, which I think needs to be mentioned just so that I can say the title. And then he was also in The Killer Wore Gloves, which is not a bad little film, worth your time, probably. And okay. If I was going to single out any of his spaghetti westerns, at least any of the movies that he had a small part in, I would single out Apocalypse Joe.
Oh, okay.
Which is a pretty interesting Anthony Steffen film. from 1970. Interesting movie, worth seeing at least once, especially if you're a spaghetti western fan.
Right. Awesome. Yeah, and he did a few of the... he's also in Night of the Sharks, of course. And he did a few of these sort of post-Vietnam action movies, like Days of Fire, and he's in another one called Messenger of Death. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, just like, again, a working actor who kept going. I mean, the IMDb doesn't say he's dead, so maybe he's just retired. I don't know, but...
Yeah, my understanding is that he's just been retired. He did do something in 2005 for a TV movie, but yeah, I don't have any information about him having passed. Yeah, so.
And he's got he's good in this film. He's got a good look. I like his character. It's quite there's some interesting scenes that we'll get to.
And here's the thing. Slash. I mean, he is, in a way, kind of, at least in the latter half of the film, he's kind of the villain of the story.
Yeah.
And in films of this type, you usually have people going a little over the top being the villain, but he doesn't do that. He plays it much more realistically and naturalistically. I mean, yeah, he's definitely the villain and he's definitely despicable, but he's not... You know, doing a lot of histrionic, over the top acting or anything like that. He's actually an accomplished actor, and he's doing a good job here. And it's
He's just chilling with these two, I don't know, like bodyguards, lady bodyguards, who are also wearing matching hot pants. And,
I know. I wonder if Mr. Candelli was able to partake of any particular bonus features involved in the casting and filming of this particular movie.
And, yeah, he's just hanging out and teaching them about fruit.
That's a strangely handled sequence in the movie where they're discussing fruit, and it was just like
it feels like there's a missing scene somewhere.
Yeah.
Because suddenly, anyway, we'll get to that. We're getting ahead of ourselves. Okay, the other two cast members that really I think are the only ones worth mentioning. Well, maybe a couple. I'm wondering whether you have more familiarity with the Spanish cast, but a
little bit.
So Rage has to team up with three people to go into the wastelands, and we'll talk about what his mission is in a minute. One of these people is a guy called Victor, played by Werner Potcher, who was Austrian. He looked really familiar to me, and I don't know whether that's maybe I've seen him in some westerns, because he's another one who worked primarily between sort of Germany and Italy.
Well, you might know him. He was in the spaghetti western Vengeance, directed by Antonio Margheriti.
Ah, yes, of course.
Not a big role, but you might remember him from it.
But he's in Cat of Nine Tails as well, of course.
Exactly. He was in a number of films that are pretty standard viewing for fans of European exploitation stuff.
Oh, and I think I've watched quite recently Iguana with the Tongue of Fire. So
right. I was going to mention that one as well. Yeah. Another standout film that you might have seen him in is one that has become a little bit more well known in the past few years. Apparently it was kind of a standard thing to view on television in the late 70s, early 80s, but really has only gotten a little bit of attention in the past few years, is a film called Sky Riders. He plays a prominent terrorist in that. It's a James Coburn film, and a pretty good little movie. It's not great, but his face is prominent in that as one of the bad guys. Okay. He was also in Magnum Cop, by the way.
And he's in he did an Umberto Lenzi film as well.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, solidly working. But then he died quite young, which is a shame. I think he was only under 50 when he died, I think.
That is a shame, because he clearly was an in-demand actor. I mean,
And then he's, as we've mentioned, though, his companion, whatever, I can't think of the word I'm looking for.
Buddy?
One of his other companion, his buddy. His potential love interest, although it's all very mainly very platonic, is a character called Mara, and she is played by the Spanish actress Taida Urizola.
Good job. I'm glad you tried that name rather than me.
Thank you. So, Rod, I'm just assuming that because they're Spanish, you know all about them.
Well, I don't know all about her, but I have seen her in a number of films. She had a small role in one of the most devastating Paul Naschy films, the one that kind of bankrupted his production company called Operation Mantis from 1985. So she had a small role in that. I'm aware of her from that. And she also played a prostitute in El Caminante, The Traveler, his 1979 film, which is honestly one of Naschy's best films, but she has a small role there. And
is that one that you've done a commentary for?
No. Did not do a commentary for that one. Troy Howarth did a commentary for that one. Fantastic film. And like I say, she has a small role in it. Highly recommended As far as Naschy films are concerned, especially the ones that people who want to stretch outside of just his horror output. And the thing is, she was in a number of other films, some that have been on my radar to eventually catch up with, but I just haven't managed to do it yet. There's one film that she has what I assume is a small role, but I'm aware of this movie called Jaguar Lives.
Yeah, Christopher Lee.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of how I already knew about it, because it's apparently a karate film that Christopher Lee has a role in, and so does Donald Pleasance. So it's one of those things where it's been on my radar to check out, just out of curiosity. Hell of an interesting cast: Barbara Bach, Woody Strode, John Huston. It's like, oh, I've got to see this eventually. I just haven't gotten around to it. So she has a small role in that. Certainly she would not be the main reason to go see Jaguar Lives, but yeah.
Yeah, she was in Red Rings of Fear, which was the third film in the sort of unofficial Schoolgirls in Peril trilogy that Massimo Dalmano started, and then he sadly died before that one was directed. So yeah, so she's done a few things with in Italy before, as well as the Spanish films. Are you familiar with Mystery on Monster Island?
I am familiar with it. It's funny. I just recently, our newest episode of the Naschy Cast, we were talking to a friend of ours, a man who also has a love of Paul Naschy, of course, or why would he be on the show? A man named John Kitley, who's written a really interesting book. He has a regular column in Horror Hound magazine. And we discussed the fact that you, as a Naschy fan, you kind of have to surmount the mountain that is Mystery on Monster Island eventually, but I had to confess that I still not managed to make myself watch it because Naschy only has like a minute or two right at the beginning of the film.
And am I dreaming this, or didn't Severin just put this out?
Did they? I don't think so. I mean, the thing is, it's been readily available on DVD for a while.
Yeah, I thought they did because it's Juan Piquer Simón, so it's
right.
You know, from the director of Slugs and Pieces comes a children. I'm sure I heard
which is how you know it's a classic. But
or am I getting it confused with Journey to the Center of the Earth?
I think you may be getting it mixed up.
Because he did Journey to the Center of the Earth as well, which I have seen, but this is different. This is not the same film.
Yeah, the thing about Manhunt on Mystery Island is that it's the kind of thing where you read about it and you go, holy crap, Terrence Stamp, Peter Cushing. There's even a, if you're a Spanish horror fan, you go Blanca Estrada, Frank Brana, Paul Naschy. And then you realize, oh, no, this is a movie built for small children, and Naschy's in it at the beginning, and that is all. And then you're going to start to feel your teeth rot from the sugar that is wrapped around this. It's just, I need to watch it. I haven't done it yet. I've owned it for almost two decades and still haven't watched it.
Wow.
I know I need to. I haven't built up enough head of steam to push my way through it yet. So,
well, what else is a podcast for, Rod? You've got to get an episode out there on that one.
But that's just it. If we cover it for the Naschy Cast, what, for 2 minutes, less than 2 minutes of Paul Naschy at the very beginning of the films? Like, I don't see that being instructive.
You could be a Naschy Cast Bloody Pit crossover episode.
Maybe so. I mean, maybe eventually Troy and I will just hunker down and cover it just so that we can. Well, as John Kittley put it in our episode of the NashyCast, he says, you got to cross it off the list, man. You just got to eventually cross it off the list. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, good I guess point. You're right.
So the other person that they're traveling into the wilderness with is played by an actor called Chris Huerta.
Love this actor.
Yeah, according to the IMDb, it says he started in Peplums in Italy and mm-hmm. went on doing typically fat, dirty bad guys in spaghetti westerns, which I'm sure he would have appreciated that description.
But that really, that kind of sells him short a bit, though. He played exactly. a lot of different kind, yeah.
Yeah, and he's in lots of interesting films. But yeah, he'd been working, by the time he made this movie, he'd already been making films for 25 years.
Yes, exactly. And the thing is, he's one of those guys who, because of the way he's built, he looks a little bit like a couple of other European actors that you mm-hmm. might think of, like Fernando Sancho. But he's a different guy, and he's fun to see. What have you seen him in?
Oh, I don't recognize him for anything. I'm looking through his list, and I'm not entirely sure that I've seen any of them. If I'm
honest. I've seen far too many of them.
He's been in a lot of films,
right?
But I couldn't say that I've. I have seen him. I've seen Cemetery Without Crosses.
Great movie.
So yeah, there's one. That might be the only one. Apart from Rage,
well, from his early career from the 70s, he is
Django. He's in Django.
He's in Django. This is
Django
true.
Alert. Okay, that's two.
Well, here's the thing. He's one of the few actors I know of who has played two different members of Robin Hood's Merry Men in different films. He was in 1970. He played Little John in The Magnificent Robin Hood. And then in 1976, he got, I don't know, promoted, demoted, which way you want to go, where he got to play Friar Tuck in another Robin Hood film. Tarnation, what was exactly the name of that one now? I can't remember. The story, okay, yeah, he plays Friar Tuck in 1976 in a movie that I guess I would have to translate the title. And what's terrible is I've seen it, and I can't remember even what its English title was. But
Storia di Archieri, well, Story of Archery.
Yeah, it's not particularly great.
Puni e Occhi Neri, something about black glasses.
Like Robin Hood, arrow, beans, and karate.
Or black Occhi Neri, isn't that black eyes? I know. Live translation is not something I'm very good at, but it's a comedy, right?
But it's a very strange one, because Friar Tuck brings along his kung fu master friend, so you can imagine both the desire to see it and the knowledge that it is not going to be great. So
yes, fair enough.
Oh, but I should point out the real. Way to see him in a very interesting role is a movie he made just a few years after this. He is in Howl of the Devil, the Paul Naschy film was almost impossible to see until recently, when Mondo Macabro put it out on Blu-ray. He plays a character in that who it's a very interesting character, very interestingly written, and he's very good in that. So that's his Naschy connection there. So.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think we've covered the cast in quite some detail there, so why don't we get into some sort of plot summary? Now, I don't know whether people... This is a film that I was not really that familiar with, and I don't know whether many people would be. I don't know how much of the story to give away, but was this a film that you were already familiar with, Rod, or is this new to you as well?
This was brand new to me, and it does my heart good to know that there are still some 1980s post-apocalyptic Italian films out there that I've not seen. This one, I wasn't sure what to expect. I went in as blind as I could, and I have to say, had not seen this one before. Did enjoy it, though.
So, yeah, I'm going to guess that there's plenty of people out there who won't have seen it either. There's a really good... I haven't really done that much research to see if it's available on DVD or anything, but there's a very good copy on YouTube at the moment, which I have I'll put a link in the show notes. But I also tweeted it out the other day if anybody wanted to watch that on YouTube. But it is actually very good and not that well known. So maybe let's not give too much of it away. I'll just read you the beginning of the book chapter on this film. Well, I say chapter, basically three paragraphs. They haven't got much to say about it. 1984, actor Conrad Nichols is not yet done with Disenchanted Tomorrows and Rude Awakenings. This book is very poetic. A year after Rage, original title, Rush. So they're calling the other one Rage. Oh, they're so confused. He dives headlong one more time into the broth of the apocalypse, reuniting with compatriot and director Anthony Richmond, a.k.a. Tonino Ricci, for a post-nuke western which would be released on VHS with a string of interchangeable titles, Rage, Rush 2, Rush 2, The Return of the Hero, or The War Beast, The War Beast, apparently.
The War Beast, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So then we get to the plot summary. Andalusia and Al Maria are once again asked to pass for post-bomb America, and it is here that the handsome Conrad embarks on a hectic adventure in the middle of the wasteland, headed toward Alpha Base, where he's supposed to find the very last reserves of uranium. And then the rest of the summary sort of gives quite a lot of the ending away, which I don't really want to do. So I think we'll just have to summarize the rest of it ourselves. But so the film starts with some kind of platoon led by Victor and Mara going through what clearly looks to me like an abandoned set,
yes,
rather than an actual street. And there are mutated people or people that have got radiation sickness lurking in the shadows. But then also there is Rage, who is remarkably handsome and uncontaminated by radiation poisoning.
Yes, yes. And clearly has access to a gem.
Yeah. Well, and he's got a car that can drive through walls, and they're hunting him down for some reason, and like they're all got guns and they're all shooting, but then also they want to capture him alive because they need him, which isn't made very clear by the amount of bullets that they're pumping in his direction. But
it's very strange. It's that standard action movie thing of, you know, we need to capture this guy because we need him because he's unique, yeah, in some particular way. Shoot directly at him, you know.
Yeah.
What are you
well,
doing?
Well, luckily, I think the all of the combatants in this film trained at the Stormtrooper Academy, because none of them can hit anything.
No, they're really really good at hitting walls as long as the yeah, walls are very very large, and that's about it.
The number of bullets to the number of times somebody actually gets shot ratio in this film. I mean, I can't do the maths, but I'd have to say it's not good.
It's roughly 1 to 1,000, yes.
Yeah. If this is really the post-apocalypse, you'd think they'd be a bit more careful with their bullets.
Certainly.
So there's this whole sort of shootout and a bunch of people get killed, and Rage is driving around in a car and he like crushes people. And yes, all kinds of stuff.
I love it. I love that sequence where he rams into the wall and kills those guys. It's like, how many? Yeah. Later on, when they're talking to him, he just offhandedly remarks that, you know, coming to get me, you know, you only lost 20 or 30 people. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's kind of a high price to pay for anybody.
I know. But then it turns out, so they eventually capture him and they bundle him into their Jeep, and He keeps kind of giving Mara the eye, like he's trying to establish a bit of chemistry there, and she just sort of rolls her eyes at him. But they head off across the wasteland back to their base, where he meets the guy in charge. So it turns out that Rage is a former, what is he, like captain of a platoon or something? They're all basically military or ex-military, and Rage just didn't want to play ball anymore, but they're all safe in some kind of bunker and he's just been outside, and actually one of them says to him, so how did you survive out there in the wasteland, you know, without getting horribly mutated? And he says, oh, it's a long story
that we're not even going to try to make up.
Yes. And then we're all like, yes, and Nothing.
So don't have time for that. We've got other things to do.
Yeah, just saying it's a long story. That's a really great get out for the script writer, isn't it? Because he's written himself into a bit of a corner. It's fine. It's a long story. We haven't got time. Move on.
Yes, exactly. So heavy stress on move on. Yes.
So this is very similar to Exterminators in the year 3000, this film, that they've got a base in one place, but the base is going to die out unless they can get the thing that's in another place. That's basically the setup, right?
Yep.
And what they need is uranium, because apparently that's what's powering their underground base. Now, I should say, the underground base that they're filming in is really cool, like whatever it is. They've got access, whatever that location is.
Yeah,
they've actually got access to a real underground concrete bunker or something that they're filming in, which is quite fun. But yeah, so they need the uranium, and they've picked up some radio signals from another base. Like, what are they? They're in Alpha Base, and then there's another base or something.
Yeah,
I forget the names of the base, but they've got to go to this other base where they've picked up this radio signal to get the uranium that's there to bring it back to power their base. I think that's the gist of it. But Rage, apparently, not Victor and Mara and their whole gang of people, Rage is the only man who can get them across there because he's so cool and because he looks so good in his tight, sleeveless, high-neck shirt. But they've also got a tech guy played by Chris Huerta, who is Omar, and he can specialise in tracking the signal that they've picked up. So basically, despite the fact that we've just seen Rage be captured by a whole platoon, I know he did kill a few of them, but still. Now they've got to go on this desperate mission to save the whole base. They're just sending four people.
I know. Why is it such a small team?
Why are they not all going? Yeah. Well, because, I mean, the real reason is because it's a lot cheaper to film four people going in one Jeep than it is to try and film a whole platoon
precisely
in the movie. But yeah, plot-wise, not quite such a good idea. So yeah, that's it then. So they are off, and Rage knows where he might be able to get a map. And so he takes them to another place that's like a kind of,
just cantina, another abandoned bar, base? I don't know.
Yeah, it's like the cantina bar, but set in an old abandoned concrete factory, probably either just outside Rome or actually somewhere in Almeria. But it's an abandoned factory that's littered with... I quite like it. It was a good detail. They keep trying to remind us that we're in America because there are occasional abandoned American cars just knocking around.
Just to try to fool us.
Yeah, what I like about this movie is that the these road warriors are not driving in souped-up Mad Max-type cars. Slash just drives around in a big brown Volvo. Like, no one stuck
across any... Across the desert, yes.
They haven't stuck any spikes on anything. They're just riding, like, motocross bikes, and the motocross guys are wearing their just actual motocross clothing, which is all really brightly coloured and like bright red helmets. There's very little attempt to futurise it up.
It really is just... I mean, I don't know if... I'm sure it was primarily a budgetary reason for this, but yeah, it just really does look like... Well, it's, you know, it's 30 years after the bomb fell or after this apocalypse or whatever the heck it is. And it's a little bit more, I guess, realistic to a degree. I guess in the Road Warrior films and the various ripoffs thereof, we're supposed to intuit that these people, you know, have a lot of time on their hands and so they get really creative, but not in this movie. So.
No. Oh, speaking of bombs, I forgot to mention that the opening of the film is all stock footage of starving people around the world intercut with
and it's
nuclear
kind of a
bombs.
Depressing way to start this thing.
Yeah. I felt we were back in Godzilla 1977 territory.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, wait, do we really need to have the real world horrors being thrust in our face like this?
At least it didn't go full Luigi Cozzi and just show us piles of burning bodies in the middle.
Yes.
Like he did with Godzilla, which yeah, was a real downer. So he takes them off to this abandoned concrete factory to meet Slash, who is another former army captain who has a big slash down his face, hence the name. And he's living in this place where everyone is dancing to top-notch 80s disco. I'll put a clip in. I think the music is quite fun.
I'm on right as well. What are you on right? Crazy.
Hand them all on. This way, gents.
Just shut it, PJ. Who are you calling me? I'm on right. What are you doing?
There they go. Down the
come on, get the lead out. Now you're doing fine. On the whole thread. Come on, move it, move it. Come on, move it. Blow, you bastard, blow.
But you've got all these guys just dancing about, and Slash is sitting there like the king of all he surveys, yep, surrounded by women in hot pants. And he just welcomes Rage like they're old friends. I mean, how would you describe... do you think there's a backstory between these two?
The backstory between these two is... they've obviously got a contentious history. They've known each other for a very long period of time, and the last time they saw each other, they did not part on amicable terms. But there's a grudging respect.
Are we supposed to believe that Rage gave him that scar?
Well, that was unclear. I mean, they don't. It's another one of those details they decided to not. I think the movie hints at it, or right. Maybe there's even a line of dialogue that points directly toward it, but I can't remember.
Okay. Yeah.
But the contentious attitude between the two of them, the relationships, obviously, neither of them would care if the other dropped dead. But the danger in effectuating that outcome on their own is probably a little more than they're willing to put forth, because neither one of them seems to be sure who would come out on top.
But but Rage lays it all out very clear what they need, and I thought that they did a deal and it was all fine. Like, they seem to have made an agreement with each other, and Slash is giving them all a drink. Yeah. So they're all having a drink of whiskey. And then suddenly, in what is quite a bizarre moment, a couple of Slash's guys just come over and grab Mara and drag her off, basically to rape her on a table. And Slash is just sitting there laughing. Rage jumps up and starts punching everybody because he's the hero of the film.
Yep.
Now, Victor, Mara's, presumably friend, I mean, certainly work colleague, they're in the same platoon or whatever. He just sits there carrying on drinking his whiskey and doesn't try and intervene at all.
Well, I have an explanation for this sequence for you. I've got this sequence figured out.
Oh, go on then.
We needed a fist fight.
Oh, right, fair enough.
That's exactly why this has happened.
Because, I mean, Mara, she's quite handy herself, as she managed to fight all these guys off. But I was sitting there thinking, come on, Victor, you douche. Why are you just not even helping a little bit? He didn't paint himself in a good light, considering Victor is supposed to be one of the heroes for the rest of the movie, and Mara seems to be very quick to forgive him. But you know, it's not cool, Victor. It's not cool.
Well, I got the thing is, if you notice the way this film and a lot of films of this type are structured, often there is a fight. So because we need a fight, we need some action sequence of some sort to kind of goose this thing along and to make sure everybody's still awake. And this to me smacked precisely of that, because there are a couple of other sequences like that in the movie too, but this one's the most obvious.
So maybe that's why they decide to wait until everyone's asleep, and then they decide to steal the map and run off. Which is what they do. And Slash, when he discovers what's happened, he's like shaking his fist at the air. I'll get you, Rage. And
Rage has infected me with his rage.
I don't know why Rage and the guys didn't just slash all of Slash's tires, you know, before they left. If they didn't want to be followed.
That's a good point. Yeah,
that would have been quite an easy thing. If they didn't want to kill everybody, fair enough. These are the good guys. I mean, they could have killed everyone. they could have at least disabled their vehicles or something, because they drive off in their Jeep and they're driving across the desert. Well, they're either driving in the desert or through a quarry. There's a lot of quarry action in this film.
Yeah, yeah. But, those are the two exterior locations they seem to have most access to. Yeah,
yeah. Either of which leave quite clear tire marks for Slash and his gang to follow.
Yes.
So then the next section of the film is basically a chase, with Slash trying to catch up with Rage, and Rage and Victor and Mara are crossing the desert, and they meet another group of people who, now if this was a Western, which it kind of is, then what they meet is a group of Native Americans who they have they develop a mutual respect, and they leave them some weapons,
yep,
so that they will be their friends. But you could have easily just swapped those guys for for the sort of typical Western Red Indian, and it would have been exactly the same. There was a bunch of guys on horses watching them from the tops of the hills, and I thought that was very much a nod to the Western, that thing there, that bit there.
Well, it is that thing once again where most of these movies, if not all of them, are really just kind of spaghetti Westerns dressed up in different clothing.
Yeah. Yes. If this was a Western, what would they be? They wouldn't be going to get uranium. What would they? Well, unless it was a William Castle Western. but if this was a Western, what would be the MacGuffin? What would they be trying to get, do you think?
Oh my goodness, it could be almost anything. It's usually going to be gold, though. It would be money of some kind of either gold or a map to some gold, or who the heck knows.
Yeah.
Could even be a rescue mission, you know.
That's true. Maybe the map they've got is a map to hidden treasure that they found during the Civil War or something. The one of the writers we should mention, Jamie Cummis Gill, was one of the writers on A Fistful of Dollars. So there's some Western heritage.
I know. I noticed his name, and there was something familiar about it. And
yeah.
I thought the reason I might know him is because he was the writer of Danger Death Ray. But no. He did Fistful of Dollars as well.
So, I don't want to go too much more, because I think if you've never seen this, there's some quite interesting stuff, actually. They follow their bearings, they follow the map, they follow the radar. I'm not entirely sure why they needed a map and the radar, but anyway, they find the transmission. So then the first question is, are they going to find the uranium? What's going to happen when they get there? But that's not even the end of the movie, which surprised me, actually. When they get to where they're looking for, it's only, like the end of the second act. There's a whole action-packed final act, which... Should we mention it's on a train? There's a train.
I know. I have to say, this one has a few things, not many, but it does have a few things that are very different from other post-apocalyptic films of the period. And this whole sequence on the train, first of all, once again, it's a Western. But this is not something that you see in your average post-apocalyptic film from this period at all. As a matter of fact, I can't think of another one that involves, I mean, other than the final sequence in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, I can't think of another one that involves a train.
Was this pre-Thunderdome or
post-Thunderdome? Yeah. Thunderdome came out in 85.
Oh, okay, so this did it first.
It
is really good, and there's some great stunt work, and Tom Cruise thinks he's all that for doing a film on top of a train. These guys were risking their lives a long time before he was. And some of this stuff looks a little bit hair-raising, I thought. There's also a great bit where one of the motorcyclists jumps his motorbike up onto the train, which is quite a risky stunt. I just saw that recently. I just watched the Jackie Chan, Michelle Yeoh film Supercop. And there's a sequence in there where Michelle Yeoh jumps a bike up onto the top of a train. And it's at a moving train. It's really dangerous. In this film, it's a stunt rider because he's got his helmet on. Whereas in Supercop, it's Michelle Yeoh actually doing it with no helmet on.
Yeah, just the clothing that she's wearing, yeah.
It's pretty amazing. But yeah, so this film's got a lot to offer. So considering, I thought, I have to confess, that by the time we got to this film and the last one we're going to do, that we're scraping the bottom of the barrel a bit here. And the filmmakers probably were too. The money was running out. It's the same old tired sets and locations and blah, blah, blah. So this film, I was pleasantly surprised at how really well made it actually is. I mean, sure, the script is a bit goofy and a bit cheesy, but, that's fine. But the action is really good.
And I was surprised by that as well. The film works. It's very entertaining from beginning to end. The only like moment in the movie where I think, well, other than the odd little bit right there at the beginning with all the stock footage that really doesn't need to be there because it really does not set the correct tone for what's coming after it. but there really is only one sequence in the film that I thought was hilariously poorly done, and it's because of the choice of music. There is this one scene. The music usually fits the movie perfectly wonderfully. No problems. It's all there. Whether it's a particularly great score or not is, up to individual tastes. But there is one sequence in which our heroes get attacked by a group of people. And for that one scene, when the music kicks in, it is the most inappropriately cheesy 1970s television cop show music I have ever heard in my life, and it's just like da 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 da. It's one of those things that just immediately makes you go, okay, this does not sound like this belongs to the rest of the score. It definitely does not fit this scene. It turns it into a jaw-droppingly funny sequence.
Yeah, and of course, it's our old friend Stelvio Cipriani, who I'm sure we've talked about many times. And I know you've talked a little bit before about how some of these guys, when they turned into the 80s and started using synthesizers, you lost interest. But then but then when you actually listen to some of them, sometimes it's quite good. I'm not entirely sure whether this would fit that, whether that would fit that category, or if this is just prime Cipriani 80s cheese.
For the majority of the film, it works just fine. It doesn't particularly draw attention to itself, so it doesn't stand out as one that I'm that achingly seeking out to listen to on its own. But that one sequence, it really does feel like it was written for something else and dropped in here.
Which is perfectly possible.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll leave that there. I think we've covered that in enough detail. So if you haven't seen this film, do watch it. We haven't spoiled it. It's on YouTube. Definitely worth your time. We'll get finished here in a minute, but I just wanted to mention we've had some feedback. We always love getting feedback, so please do get in touch. Twitter and Instagram or email are all ways that you can get in touch with us. So we had a message actually just yesterday from one of our regular listeners, Mark Eggins. And he says, by the way, guys, I know you don't want to cover Giallo, but you could. Well, I don't know if I wouldn't say so much I don't want to, just that I think other people have already done it. But he makes a good point here. He says, you could look at a very specific subset, although Art Giallo has already been done quite entertainingly by Kat Ellinger and co. on a co-host on Daughters of Darkness. But, he says, but is it a Giallo? A podcast series on titles that are arguably Giallo, but there is a lot of debate about or Giallo adjacent. I mean, there's nothing people love arguing about more than is it a Giallo or not.
It's an argument I've never... I think I had a brief interest in that argument somewhere in the late 90s and then realized that I didn't give a damn.
I certainly think it would be a good excuse to maybe come up with some films that would fit that category that are not ones we would otherwise cover. But is it a Giallo or not? I mean, there is so much scope there. I mean, just off the top of your head, Rod, can you think of any that might qualify?
Oh my goodness. What's terrible is that I keep getting... Okay, there was this magic thing on the internet years ago. I don't know if it still exists, but it was a giallo title generator.
Oh, right.
I remember spending so much time playing with that thing, just laughing myself to death, that right. Now I have all of these fake titles stuck in my head, like Traces of Dark Red on the Cold Metal Table, you know, just things like that. Mm-hmm. So now I have trouble trying to access the titles of actual films.
Yeah, I know
that,
what you mean.
That may or may not be giallos, but have those yeah. titles, you know, those titles, you know, that involve, you know, either blood or a random animal, you know, the ocelot cries at midnight or something. I don't know.
I used to play around a lot on, I used to get involved quite a lot about not more than 10 years ago, probably, on Cult Labs, which was a forum for all things cult film. But they would do a competition every week that was always sponsored by people like Arrow or Shameless and so on. And I won loads of DVDs and stuff over the years, but one of the things they would do regularly was kind of Photoshop competitions, and so I was always making fake giallo Blu-ray covers, like puns, like you said, like making up animal ones and
right.
Well, cause so I've got the similar problem that I sometimes think of things and I think, oh no, that wasn't a real film. That was one I made.
That's one you made up. Well, it's like okay,
I'll have to tweet some of those out.
Well, you get into the questions of things like okay. What are the requirements? What are the parameters of what is a giallo and isn't? So like yeah. is Seven Deaths in a Cat's Eye a giallo, even though it's not? You know, it's usually I think of giallos as being set in modern day, uh-huh. and you know, Seven Deaths in a Cat's Eye is a period piece. So, but it's often referred to as a giallo, and it's like I don't know. It really doesn't seem like one to me. I mean, kind of, sort of, I suppose.
Yeah, and it does have a gorilla.
This is true, and you know there are the weird ones that I think we'd have to categorize as a giallo, but kind of go against the grain by having a single word title like torso. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it crosses kind of into horror territory. Well, it's kind of a horror movie in my opinion. I think Torso is more of a horror movie than a giallo, but it has giallo elements. You know, definitely.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, or films where the title says it's a giallo, but the film itself is not a giallo.
Well, see, that's the weird part is is Death Laid an Egg a giallo yeah. or not?
I mean, I would say not at all. I mean, I don't know what that film is, but
it's definitely something different. That's for sure.
It's not a giallo. Yeah, well, there you go. See, you've already got us started off there, Mark. So thank you. Yes, we'll think about that. Also had some feedback about a week ago that I just wanted to mention. Sean Baker got in touch, who it's great to know, Sean, that you're listening. And he told us that he loves the podcast. Well, I'll just, instead of let me start again. I won't just try and rephrase this in the third person. I'll just read it. It says, hello, just wanted to let you know I love your podcast and I just listened to your commentary on The Sex of Angels. Thanks, Sean. And so then he's got a question, which I thought I would pose for you, Rod, and see what you think.
Okay.
It says, I have a question for you. Is the film Top Sensation a ripoff of Sex of Angels? So many similarities. Now, I think we did talk about Top Sensation on the commentary, but I don't know if we got down to the... to really figuring out which is which. I did check, and Sex of Angels came out a year before Top Sensation. So it's definitely that way round. But what do you think?
It's difficult to know. I mean, yes, the stories are similar. The real difference is what's on the minds of the filmmakers in each case. I think what's going on in Sex of Angels is very different from... kind of, it's the ages of the characters. It's the ages of the female leads that make Top Sensation have a very different kind of feel for me.
Right.
The similarities are there. Don't get me wrong. But I never really thought that Top Sensation was covering or copying or kind of taking from it. Because quite honestly, it's not a particularly unique setup. One could argue that Repulsion but Knife in the Water, Roman Polanski's film, is also a variation on that same kind of story, while not, you know, while being very different from both of those films. The idea of whether it's a copy or not, it's like it's good. It maybe a side by side, maybe a close watch of both films would maybe pull out threads that seem to be closer than my memory. My memory of Top Sensation tells me it is. I'm not sure.
Sean does mention, he says, I saw so many similar images. So I think there are some close comparison, sort of textual comparisons you can make there.
Yeah,
he does
say,
I hope somebody puts out an HD version of Top Sensation soon. You're right. Yes, it's only on that Shameless DVD, I think. Well, over here anyway. And that's another film that deserves an upgrade. I mean, who wouldn't want to see that film in all of its HD potential?
Well, the cast, the cast alone seems like it would be.
But I think it's interesting. Yeah. You make a good point there about the ages. Sex of Angels is seems to be about teenagers, right?
Right.
Basically. Whereas Top Sensation, they're all more kind of late 20s. And then the older women sort of gang up on the younger woman who's naive and innocent, and there's a sort of there's almost a generation gap just between them on the boat, I suppose. There's another difference, but you're right, maybe all of this goes back to Knife in the Water anyway,
or maybe even further. Maybe there's something previous to that I'm not even thinking of. But
well, like, I mean, Sean also mentions that In Terror Bang is very similar as well, which he hasn't seen, but he says, I've never seen it, but I'm downloading it now. Now, when when we were preparing to do Sex of Angels, I can't even remember how long ago that was, but I also downloaded In Terror Bang, but didn't actually get around to watching it. But there are also some similarities, although I think that's more about a rich couple on a yacht who exploit somebody young. So there's another element of that as well.
Once again, a different kind of thing. But
I mean, I did reply to Sean to say maybe we should do a Young Rich People on Yachts mini season. Maybe we could schedule that in for next summer.
I would not be against it.
No, maybe we could record it from our own yachts.
Yes, of course. I'll have to decide which of my various yachts to choose, but yes.
Well, I assume that's why you're buying your own place now, right? So you can have a marina, is that?
Well, I do. Yeah, I do want a spacious you got a backyard jetty, where I can park all of my various vehicles.
So, yeah, well, thank you, Sean, again, for getting in touch, and also Mark, and anyone listening who wants to, we do love to hear from you. It's nice to know that the podcast isn't just going out into a big blank space, that people are actually listening. So we do love hearing from you. So next episode, which is unlikely to be next week.
Yeah, very unlikely, yes.
Next episode will be our last one, although that's another bit of feedback I should mention.
Oh, okay.
So next, I'll look it up and also talk at the same time. So our next episode will be another film which I'm unfamiliar with, called The Final Executioner. And I don't know if that's one that you know and love.
Actually, no, it is another one. At first I did think that I had seen it, but I'll be honest, I don't think I have.
But I was going to mention, so that's our last one on the list, but we have a listener who's been kind of, you know, I don't want to say beg, because that sounds, that's the wrong phrase, but
okay.
he's been asking me several times now on Twitter if we will do the film Warrior of the Lost World.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Which is, again, that's a 1983 one. I don't think I mentioned, actually. I failed to mention that Man Called Rage was 1984. But anyway, Warrior of the Lost World is kind of Italian. It is Italian, but it's very American but it's got Donald Pleasance. I think it's another one passing itself off as American. So I don't know. Maybe we could throw that one in. What I would like to do again at the end Is where we rank.
Do want to throw in an extra film, we could do Warriors of the Wasteland there at the end. I wouldn't bother me.
What I think we'll do, so we'll make our final proper episode, the final Executioner, but then maybe we can do an episode where we rank all the films, but we could also just throw in on that episode what we think about Warrior of the Lost World. How about that?
Works for me. Now, okay, is this the same film I'm thinking of that that's also known as Warriors of the Wasteland?
Yes, I think.
Oh,
so.
Wait a minute! No, Warriors of the Wasteland is another title for the New Barbarians. See, this is the problem.
Yeah, no, this is Robert Ginty and Donald Pleasance.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's the horrible. Yeah, Warriors of the Lost World. Robert Ginty, Donald Pleasance, Persis Cambata.
Yeah. So yeah, so it's an American director, but shot in Italy. And anyway, maybe. So okay, so Rich, if you're listening, we've just put it out, so it's official now. we will fit Warrior of the Lost World in as a bonus episode. Now, if I could be bothered to do a Patreon, that's the kind of thing we could stick on Patreon. But
I do the Patreon thing.
You do that, yeah. But no. I don't think I'm ready to go there just yet. It's hard enough keeping up with what we're doing. So anyway, okay, we're going to stop there. Rambling on, this episode is approaching record-breaking length. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And do get in touch, as I keep saying. Twitter, Instagram, emails, all the links are in the show notes, or you can find them on our, on anywhere you want to look. I don't know. Or just stop someone in the street and say, hey, do you know how to get in touch with the Wild Wild Podcast? And they'll tell you. That's all I've got. Thank you, Rod, again for being here. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back soon. Bye for now.
Everyone, thank you for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.